The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Library of Philadelphia, my name is Andy Cahan, and I want to take care of a little housekeeping before we start. As usual, please turn off your cell phones. Also, we had a typo on one of our flyers that went out. The Case for Impeachment event, which is on this Thursday at 12 o'clock, said the date was Thursday. And anyway, it's this Thursday, 12 o'clock, with Barbara Olshansky and with Dave Lindorf. Also, to those of you who are purchasing books today, we have book plates for sale. We will have a line upstairs, a greeting line to meet Dan, but not a counseling line. They have to get back to the station and do some promos and things of that nature because the book tour is about to start. So I would urge you to stop by and say hello, but leave it at a greeting. If you have more to say, Dan has a blog entitled letterstosan.com, and you can go there to raise any issue or have a discussion you'd like. Let's see, what else do I have here? I think that's it. So enjoy the event. To introduce Dan and to interview Dan, we have his producer, Mike and Scott, who produces a chef's table and a little show you probably know called Voices in the Family. Please welcome Mike and Scott.
Thank you. I'm sure Dan Gottlieb is no stranger to anybody in this room. However, I will just do a quick introduction of Dan. Daniel Gottlieb began his practice as a family therapist in 1969. In 1979, while preparing a surprise for his wife on their 10th anniversary, Dan was in a near-fatal car accident, which left him paralyzed from the chest down. Despite this, and despite experiencing many more devastating losses, Dan kept moving along, as our colleague James Tucker at WHYY would say. He managed to maintain his practice and continued to help and counsel people over these years. In 1985, Dan Gottlieb started to host Voices in the Family, an award-winning radio show on WHYY, which focuses on psychological and social issues. Heard Mondays at noon, as you hopefully know. Since 1993, he has been writing a bi-monthly column for the Philadelphia Inquirer entitled Inside Out. He has published three books, Voices in the Family. The second one was Voices of Conflict, Voices of Healing. And his new book, of course, is Letters to Sam, which we're talking about today. And with that, I would like to welcome Dan onto the stage. No? Come on out. And we'll start our interview.
Okay. Afternoon. Thanks for coming out on such a gorgeous day.
Okay. Dan, your grandson Sam was born 6 years ago. Is that when the idea for the book was born as well?
No. That's when I wrote my first column to Sam. And part of the reason for that column, I adored him from the moment he was born, but not as a grandson in a weird way. I adored him for what he did for my child, Debbie. Debbie, as you know, had a difficult life. Her mother had cancer when she was one, and she was incapacitated for a year. 3 years later, I broke my neck, and I was in the hospital for 10 months. Then her mother was diagnosed with MS, then a divorce. I mean, she had a difficult adolescence. And when she was pregnant, she got more excited. And when she gave birth, she had a C-section. So I was with her. We were hanging out and laughing up until the time they took her down for the C-section. And then I saw her maybe an hour after. She was a different woman. I have never seen her look that happy. And for that, I loved Sam. So that was my first letter.
When did you start loving Sam for Sam as a grandfather?
About the same time he started loving me. I wrote a letter in the book called Lap Time, which is a variation on a highly recognized treatment for autism called Floor Time. But Sam and I, we had our distance for the first 6-9 months. I mean, we were 3 hours away. We didn't quite get each other. And then my dad died. And it was at the funeral that I sat graveside. We decided to bring him, or his parents decided to bring him. He crawled over to me and tried to climb up on my lap. He'd never done that before. And he did. His mother put him up on my lap, and he just wanted to sit there as I was crying. And I believe at a certain level he knew I was suffering, and he wanted to be with me. And that might be unique to his autism, which wasn't diagnosed then, but I think it's all children. All children have that level of compassion, and it gets socialized out of them, unfortunately.
How is your love for Sam and your relationship with him different from the love that you have for your children? What's unique about being a grandfather to you?
Well, the common saying, I think, is true, that the bond between grandparents and grandchildren is we have a common enemy. You know what I mean, don't you? not enemy, of course, in the serious sense, but I mean, there is.
You're lucky your daughters aren't here.
I mean, he and I team up together and not listen an awful lot to Mom. And there's a lot more tickling, and there's a lot more. I love when Debbie points her finger at both of us. I'll stop that. And I'll say to her, well, he made me hyper.
When did you start to suspect that Sam may have autism? What were some of the early signs that you saw?
He was about a year old, 14 months old, 15. And he just stopped babbling. It was right at the time when we were looking for words to be formed, and the babbling stopped. And a lot of parents with autism report this. There's a regression. You don't tell at birth. And then he seemed to stop hearing or paying attention. If he was watching television or something, we'd talk to him. We'd even holler, and he wouldn't turn his head. And one time, my struggle was, I suspected it, and my struggle was, am I just being over-anxious? And what's my responsibility as a parent who's also a psychologist? Well, when do I introduce this possibility that might break my daughter's heart? And she knew. She told me she was concerned about his lack of hearing, and I said, when he's watching TV, bang some pots and pans. And we did, and he didn't turn around. And I said, there's something wrong. We have to check it out. And first, we checked out his hearing, and of course, I hoped it might be a hearing problem. But it was what we feared after we took him to Johns Hopkins, and he was diagnosed with PDD, pervasive developmental disorder, which means he's on the continuum.
As you got the news, what happened to you? What happened to your daughter? Dan, you have experienced so many losses over the course of your life. Were you not furious at that moment and said enough already?
I usually don't do anger about that. Maybe that's a lie, too. I don't know. But I was angry then. I was angry for what happened to Debbie. I thought, you know, she's lived with disability her whole life. And I was worried about Debbie. I mean, one of the letters in the book was how whenever I had called Deb up until this time, I said, "How's Sam?" And she would say, "Perfect." And now we got this diagnosis, and he is no longer. So I was angry at first. But Debbie was amazing. She helped me through it because she continued to say, "Sam's perfect." Not because she was in denial, because she was right. He was, he is.
How did all of this change the focus of the book you wanted to write for Sam? At first, I believe you wanted to write a book for your grandson because you feared that you would not be around for very long. So you just wanted to have a lasting kind of relationship with him in the form of these letters. Now you have a grandson who has autism. How did that change what you wanted to write to him?
The book did have a quality of urgency right from the beginning because I had been ill several times, and I was pretty confident that Sam was going into a world I would not see, that he would not get to know his pop very well, certainly not to get to know what I've learned, what I thought, felt, feared, wished for. So, it felt urgent. I wanted to write this book while I still had my life. And then he was diagnosed. And then I had more to tell him. I wanted to tell him about being different and what autism means and what autism doesn't mean and what quadriplegia means and doesn't mean. I've got a letter here that addresses that.
Will you read it?
It's called "Seeing the Person." Excuse me. "Dear Sam, I can hardly bear to think of it, but I know that someday you're going to overhear someone saying, 'He's autistic.' At that moment, I fear you will realize that when some people look at you, they won't see Sam. They'll see a diagnosis, a problem, a category, and not a person. In May 1969, when I was 24, a woman named Norma taught me how limiting such labels can be. I was a brand new psychologist working in an acute psychiatric care ward of a city hospital. Treating Norma was part of my training. I was not a very good student. I didn't retain information very well, and all I knew about psychotherapy was that it lasted 50 minutes. It was the 60s. Norma, on the other hand, she had experience. She'd been in and out of psychiatric hospitals for more than 35 years. Her chart said, quote, 'schizophrenic.' That was the label she wore as she shuffled into my office for the first time. She came to the meeting with a sheaf of papers clutched in her hand. Of course, I had to demonstrate right away that I was the knowledgeable professional who would be able to help her. As soon as I started talking, Norma began tearing papers. I didn't want to ask her why. I was afraid the question might make her mad. And I had the notion that if the patient gets mad, that's bad therapy. If the patient doesn't get mad, that's good therapy. It was a long 50 minutes. But finally we were done. Norma got up from her seat, shuffled to the door, clutching her shredded paper. As she got to the door, she turned to me and she said, 'You know something?' I said, 'What?' She said, 'You're full of crap.' And she said, 'And I have the papers to prove it.' Truth be told, the word wasn't crap, but my editors thought that was a nice word. That was the beginning of my relationship with Norma and my first glimpse of the person behind the label. She was right about me. She knew it, and I knew it. And after that, I didn't have to pretend I was something I wasn't. I didn't have to make her believe I knew what I was doing, because both of us knew I had very little idea what I was doing. And somehow, that was okay with Norma. Certainly her brain worked differently from mine because she had schizophrenia, but she was not a schizophrenic. She had told me I could stop pretending, and she had the papers to prove it. Now we could see each other clearly as people. Norma never frightened me, though her appearance could sometimes be frightening. She looked very old, her mouth was always parched. She made a constant pill-rolling motion with her thumb and index finger, a common side effect of medication. Also, she'd get agitated at times to a point where she needed to be restrained. But I wasn't afraid of her. During the time Norma and I spent together, I was quite sure there was nothing to fear. Shortly after your Aunt Allie was born, my firstborn child, I brought her into my hospital office to introduce her to my colleagues. The baby in my arms immediately drew an audience. Though my attention was on Allie, I noticed Norma out of the corner of my eye. She was about 30 feet away, standing in the middle of a public space, making odd gestures, as she often did. She seemed pretty lost inside her own mind. But gradually, her attention was drawn to the admiring crowd and the object of their attention, the little pink bundle. Slowly, over a period of about 5 minutes, Norma began to calm down. She made her way slowly towards me. By the time she got to me, her eyes looked perfectly clear. She didn't say anything. She just held out her arms, wanting to hold Allie. I placed my child in her arms and watched her. This scary, disturbed woman be as sweet and nurturing as anyone could be. Then she handed the baby back to me, went into the public space, and again got lost inside her mind. Would I hand my infant daughter over to a schizophrenic? No. But I entrusted her to Norma. Norma's illness was a disease of her brain, but her soul was unimpaired. By the way, Allie does not like that story. She said to me this weekend, "Your firstborn? You should do that with your secondborn." Sam, I know your mother struggles with having you categorized as autistic. While she realizes you must be classified that way in order to receive services, she also knows you're much more than autistic. She fears that once you have the label, that's all anyone will see. As I'm watching you grow, your abilities change almost every day. From our research into PDD, your parents and I also know that it will interfere with your ability to be flexible, pick up on social cues. We were told that you would have trouble with fine motor dexterity, but no problem with gross motor skills. So the label we learned, PDD, helped tell us some important things about your disability. But it was only a starting point. Now you're talking quite a bit. He doesn't stop now. And we're learning more about who you are. Every day we make discoveries about your abilities and your limitations. And mine. So, it's quite true that you have to deal with autism, but autism is not who you are. A couple of weeks after my accident, I was lying in my hospital bed, and I heard my doctor in the hallway saying, that quad in 301, did he get his medication? Just a couple of weeks ago, I'd been Dr. Gottlieb in some circles. In others, Dan. In others, Daddy. And now I was the quad. Who didn't turn their cell phone off? Well, Sam. What?
You're the popular guy.
You know what bothers me about my cell phone ringing? Not only am I embarrassed at the moment, but my friend Mikan is going to torture me about this for a long time. Well, Sam, over the years, I've learned that I'm not a quadriplegic. I have quadriplegia. You are not autistic. You have autism. Because of our labels, some people will be afraid to approach us. Other people will be cautious about talking to us or trusting us. With my spinal cord injury, with your autism, we look different and act different. But we can also teach people, as Norma taught me, that no matter what happens to our bodies and our minds, our souls remain whole. Love, Pop.
Dan, you speak so much about alienation, about being different, about making eye contact with people. What has being in a wheelchair taught you about that? Of course, you spoke to a lot of it in this letter, but if you could summarize what you've learned about alienation from your perspective being in a wheelchair.
I always felt alienated. Even when I was 9 years old, I was small. My sister was a superstar. I did poorly in school. In hindsight, I had a learning disability. I always felt different. And I always thought that if I was smart enough and compensated enough, and I'd be okay. Being in a wheelchair, I lost hope for ever being part of again. And that's what I call my terrifying gift, that I've had no choice. If I'm ever going to be comfortable with my life, I have to be comfortable being different. And I've considered myself, partly because of the radio show and the newspaper column, but partly because of the way I see the world, I've always considered myself a foreign correspondent. Kind of reporting back about what it means to be human. So, but one other thought about alienation is Marion Woodman says, she's a Jungian analyst, says the divine child, inner spiritual child in all of us, is always an orphan. And whenever I ask, I could ask this group, is there anybody here who has not felt alienated in their lives, has not felt like a foreign correspondent? Anybody? It's a human phenomenon. It's just a question of what we do with it.
So do you think part of the reason we all chase after things, we all want to be maybe richer, thinner, more successful, we want to accomplish more, do you think a big part of that is because so few people are comfortable with who they are and instead they try to aspire to be something they are not?
Right, right. They try to aspire to be someone they're not, to compensate for defects they perceive in themselves. And deep down, they know they'll never be the person they have in their heads. They know that's a guaranteed failure. And the problem is the perception of the defect. I gave a talk last year to the Psychoanalytic Society, and I said to them, patients call you with the perception of pathology. You greet them at your door with the presumption of pathology. and then you get to work. And I said, what if the problem is the perception and your presumption? What if there is no pathology? And I think that's the case 95% of the time. It is the perception of pathology. We all have that voice in our head that beats us up, and we assume it's right. Or we assume if we do enough or work enough, then the voice will say, oh, okay, now I'm happy. The voice is not going to go away. It's what we do with it. Voice is part of us.
You told an interesting story recently about how we all perceive things and how that is not necessarily true. You were talking about being in Disneyland and being able to get on the buses via a ramp. So would you just talk about that experience a little bit?
I was in Disneyland. It was the first time I was there. And I was thrilled about wheelchair access throughout the park, but specifically their shuttle bus. I mean, I was in one of the remote villages, one of the 97, I think, remote villages. That place is the best and worst of America. All of and I could take the bus. I mean, that's an unusual experience for me. I could get on any bus I wanted, and I was thrilled. But in order to get on the bus driver has to get off and lower the ramp and then lock me into the bus. It takes, I don't know, 5 minutes, maybe less. So the first time he did it, I wasn't aware of what anybody was thinking or saying. I was thrilled. And then the next time he did it, I was looking at people watching me, and I was thinking, well, they're probably thinking, that's great. He can go and do what everybody else does. That's great. And then the third time, it was either really hot or rainy or something. And then I'm telling myself, well, they're probably thinking, I wish it didn't take that long. It's getting on my nerves. And the fourth time it happened, I was even more self-critical, or telling myself they were more critical. So what's true? I mean, all of the above, none of the above. It's just a question of where my mind rests at any given moment. That's all. I mean, our minds are like, you know, most of our minds. Yours is like mine. It's like a chipmunk on steroids. You know? So it's where it stops for this millisecond, it'll be gone.
But what do you do? I'm thinking, this happens to all of us all the time, and I'm sure you've learned some coping skills over the years where you have a way to guide your mind back to where you want to be or where you feel more comfortable. So what are some of the things you've learned how to deal with a situation like that when you think everybody is staring at me, everybody, you know, I shouldn't be here, or, you know, that kind of situation?
I had an experience a couple weeks ago. I was feeling vulnerable for some reason. I don't know. I had a difficult week. But whatever the reason, I was just feeling not strong psychologically. I went out to dinner with four of my friends, two couples. And these people had known each other longer than I had known them. So, you know, the dialogue goes between them. And I'm comfortable joining in and enjoying myself for about the first 20 minutes. And then they were talking about something that I didn't understand. So I was quiet for a while. And then they talked more, and I was quiet more. And then I started thinking, the chipmunk. God, I don't belong here. I mean, five is a weird number, and, you know, and they know stuff that, you know, the chipmunk, you know, it's gone. And then I thought, oh, damn, I am nuts right now. I hate when that happens. I really hope it doesn't last long. And I just sat there, partly suffering, and just partly watching how nuts I was. And truth of the matter is, by the time dinner was over, it was about 20% diminished. And then I'm getting into my van, and I'm thinking, uh-oh, this could get really bad, this nutsness now. And I just watched it for the rest of the evening. It went away. I didn't notice it go away. But that's one way of coping. You know, I don't take my mind too seriously. I mean, mind is a terrible thing to have, and it's something you should never go into by yourself.
I love that Dan once compared the mind to a badly functioning kidney. And I always like that, because you said it doesn't filter out the unimportant stuff. It just pops in,
We need a bladder for our mind.
So I know you've done a lot of mindfulness meditation, and that teaches you to observe your thoughts as just thoughts. Has that helped you with a lot of the feeling alienated, with being different, with just being able to sit there and thinking it's just a thought?
I conclude my book with a poem by Rumi called The Guest House. And Rumi says, do we have it handy? Can I?
Mm-hmm. Sorry, where is it? Guest House.
You want to read it?
No. It's your book.
Final answer? This being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the sham, the malice. Meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. And that's kind of how I do my life. I'm not normal. I'm not stable. I mean, what comes in. And I know it's only temporary. I addressed that issue, I think, squarely when I went to play golf with Sam. You know, and the golf course had great, great meaning to me. And when I was with Sam in the moment on the golf course, I felt as full and as happy and as exhilarated as I have felt in a long time. And then my mind would drift to when I could play golf, and I would suffer terribly. I'd ache, I'd long for what I felt, and then I'd come back, and I'd be there with Sam in the moment, and then my mind would wander into, well, maybe I could, maybe there's some variation, and then I'd suffer again, and then I'd come back to the moment. And that's what I realized. That when we live the life we have and don't live the lives we want and we stop trying to remake our past, we just live the life we have, even if it's suffering, even if it's pain. Live the life we have, then we can be more alive. I've always said death is not a big problem. Not living is the problem. And follow the wisdom of Rumi, and we'll be more alive. And that's partly what the book's about.
You have described your accident
as... I get nervous when you roll your eyes before
I'm not rolling my eyes. I was in deep thought. You have described your accident as a gift. And you've also told the story that when the accident first happened, you weren't sure if you were able to live with your disability, if you wanted to live. Then a person came into your life, a nurse, who needed your help, and from your hospital bed, you counseled that person, and that gave you the idea that, yes, I can do this, I can still be me, I can still help other people, and that was a big inspiration for you to go on. And you've struggled greatly over the years, even in the last 10 years that I've known you. You've been very sick, close to death a few times. You've lost your sister, you lost your parents. How do you keep going, and how do you give so much to others? Where does your strength come from?
It's really not strength. I can't not. It's what feeds me, but I think it's what feeds all of us. There is a reason why every Bible ever written, every great thinker, every philosopher, every God image in our lives has talked about generosity and caring for the world and welcoming the stranger. That's the message. You boil down every Bible, every religion, that's the message. And why? I know, as a psychologist, that doing that, the byproduct of altruism, of deep caring, is it raises endorphins, the body's natural antidepressants. There's a reason why these kinds of messages have had so much staying power. That once we understand at a fundamental level that pronouns, personal pronouns, are basically an illusion, the I, me, we, that we are simply part of the world. And that once we understand that caring for the world is the only way we can care for ourselves, our children, and our families, I think happiness and serenity is inevitable. This book is partly a love story. It's partly a memoir. It's mostly my prayer for the world. That's what it's about, and that's what my life is about. I'd like to see everybody's life be about that, about caring for the world we will not see, for the sake of our children and our grandchildren.
And is that your hope for the world that Sam will grow into and all the other children?
My wish is that if 10%, 1% of the people who read this book take it in, hold on to it, and as a result, feel softer inside, have their heart a little more open, care a little bit more for the world, and do something about that caring, I'll be thrilled beyond imagination.
We want to open the discussion up to everybody in the audience. So there's a microphone here and a microphone over there. So if you have a question for Dan, just step up to the microphone and Dan will answer your question. Yes, you've answered it all, Dan. There we go. Okay, we'll start with you, sir.
You spoke about Sam and the impact that it had on your daughter, Deb, is it? Mm-hmm. But you haven't spoken anything about Sam's father and where he is in the whole situation. I wonder if you could comment.
There's a letter in the book about Sam's dad and my dad. Sam's dad, when I first met him, when I first went to his house, Deb and Pat, his name, were dating. And he was very, very concerned about details, the angle of the ramp, the width of the door, the height of the table. And he knew what questions to ask, and he did it because he cared. I can tell people's level of compassion with the kind of questions they ask. He wasn't asking them because he had anxiety. He was asking because he cared, and I felt it right from the beginning. When there's a lot of autism in Pat's family, so he knows. And when they first got the diagnosis, Pat's eyes welled up with tears. And he said, well, you know what? If he can't learn in school, Pat wasn't able to learn in school either. He's got a fairly significant learning disability. He said, if he can't learn in school, I'm going to take a year off of work, and he and I are going to sail around the world, and I'm going to teach him everything he needs to know. That's his father.
Thank you.
Dr. Howard Pollack, who is now deceased, unfortunately, was a urologist in Philadelphia, practicing up at Episcopal Hospital, which is a second or third level hospital. And one weekend, he was trying to change a window pane at home. The glass broke and cut the tendons in his hand. So he couldn't do urology anymore and went into radiology. Well, the man happened to be brilliant, with a mind like a steel trap, and could remember details from 20 years ago. And he became an international, world-renowned radiologist who wrote the definitive textbook on urography. And in a sense, I think of you in the same light. The accident was unfortunate, but had you not had the accident, your life would have been very different. Both positive and negative.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. You know, I realized yesterday I was talking to someone. You know, what makes music really beautiful is not so much the notes, but what happens between the notes, the silence between the notes. And I think, I don't love being a quad, but the good news about that is because I am forced to sit, I'm able to hear the silence. And that's why I call myself a foreign correspondent, because I report back about the silence. That's all I'm doing now, is reporting back what I see happening between the notes. And that's why the message I give sounds pretty simple. It's not a complex message. It's pretty simple. It's the quiet between the notes.
My question was very similar about, are there positives to what happened? For example, do you think you're a better grandfather to Sam because of the losses that you've suffered in your own life?
Yeah, there's a lot of benefits. I don't know if I'm a better grandfather. I think I would be maybe more understanding grandfather. But there are a lot of benefits. I mean, aside from good parking space, aside from the ability to induce great guilt in anybody at a moment, only since my accident have I been able to talk my way out of parking tickets, out of a moving violation. But there are other benefits. One I alluded to earlier when I talked about the silence between the notes, I can't run away from my demons. I can't run away from that which scares me. I can't overcompensate. That's a gift. I must find a way to make peace with my demons. That's the gift. That's why Rumi's poem is in there.
We'll go to the gentleman on our left.
Okay. Dan, thank you very much for your show and everything else you are doing.
You can thank Mike. And
well, thank you also, Mike, and yes. When you have a disability, you know, and you are placed in that role of being different, at least in that way, how do you think about the balance between educating people or teaching something and when you stop doing that and are living your private life, you know, getting, learning for yourself. And so I guess maybe it's thinking about those being different and being normal.
Don't go away yet. I'm not quite clear on your question.
I'm not either. I think I'm aware that there are times when I'm out in public and I'm totally blind. So there are times when I'm out and people will want to ask a lot of questions. And there are times when I feel like answering them. There are times when I just want to be with my friends and have a normal night out.
Okay.
And there's something very rewarding about answering those questions, and there's something sometimes when you don't really want to. At least I don't sometimes want to. So I'm kind of interested if you have had that same experience and how you manage it.
No, I haven't. Most people, I almost wish they would ask more questions. Most people don't. Those who are curious stay away from me. Children come up to me. And parents pull them away so as, quote, not to get in his way. Mm. But that hasn't happened. Hearing your question, it sounds on the surface as though you are clear about the difference. But yeah. The fact that you're standing in front of the microphone suggests maybe you're not.
Yeah, I guess mostly for me it depends on how much of a relationship if you have with the person. Maybe it's kind of like when you're talking about Pat, if you feel like sometimes other people are asking the questions out of anxiety or caring,
mm-hmm.
Or whether you have a relationship or people take the time to even make a 30-second relationship with you before asking the question. I'm not sure.
Now you're getting at it. Now I understand. Yeah, I can feel anxiety a mile away. And when people are asking me questions as a way to manage their own anxiety versus questions as a way to truly understand who I am. And the difference for me is if on any given day I'm feeling strong and generous inside, I'm happy to help the people with anxiety feel less anxious. Mm-hmm. And if I'm not feeling strong and generous that day, that moment, hopefully I won't say something sarcastic, although there's a chance. And I'll just go on my own way. It's just how I feel at the moment, like everything else. Did I get at your question?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Dr. Gottlieb.
Doesn't anybody have questions for Mike? And sorry.
I was fortunate to find you on radio. And if I'm lucky enough, I listen to you. Is it every Monday now? Is
that? Yeah, okay. Thank you.
And you have the ability to make one maybe laugh and cry at the same time, you know, which we all have the same opportunity, but we don't always do it. We hold back. You don't hold back. You speak from the from your gut or your heart, but I just want to thank you. And on a side note, if you could give me a short response. I did hear your a couple of years ago. I guess your interview with John Nash.
And, right in this exact spot.
Oh, but I heard a recording of it maybe at a later date. Oh, this would, I wasn't here. But just in a selfish way, could you shortly or in a short sentence tell us how John Nash is doing and what he's doing? I know it's not pertinent, but I was just curious.
I could probably answer your first question better about holding back. I would suggest to you that you wouldn't hold back either if you had 24 hours to live. You would live your life fully and not have anxiety about tomorrow or other people's thoughts. Mm-hmm. And I can't honestly say my life, I live my life as though, but real close to that. I really don't trust tomorrow. I don't have time to crap around. I have time to play with you. I have time to figure out how your heart works and tell you how mine does. That I have all the time in the world, but I don't have time to crap. My life is too precious. My moments are. I'll just say this about John Nash. I was terrified about that interview. And we came out here, I sat here, John sat there, and in my opening question, he gave me all the reason in the world to be terrified. I ruminated about that question for weeks, about that opening question. I asked the opening question, and he answers a completely different question. And I thought, oh my God, I am interviewing Robin Williams with an IQ of 500.
Is it available anyplace?
It's still online. It's still on our website, the interview is. So we have an archive there with all the old interviews, and it's still there at our website. All right, we'll take, I guess, one more question. I'm sorry.
I was just curious. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Oh, you can go. Okay.
Go ahead.
I was just curious, how's Sam coming along in his development?
How's Sam coming along? If you spent a day with him, well, you see his pictures. I mean,
he's beautiful.
He's gorgeous. If you see his pictures, you can see he makes eye contact. He's very high functioning.
And he loves having his picture taken, by the way. He's always like...
So, if you spent a day with him, you wouldn't know. However, if something went wrong in that day, you would know. He'd have a meltdown. Or if something unpredictable happened that day. Or if he opened a candy bar and the bar was broken, he would collapse on the floor. So, and if you saw him with his peers, you would know. But in the broad scheme of things, he's doing extremely well. And there's critical stages in the development of somebody with PDD, so we don't know how it's going to turn out. You know, yeah. He's going through one of his stages now, and is all of a sudden he's writing, he looks dyslexic, he's not getting his letters right. That wasn't there several months ago.
Yeah, I know what you're going through a little bit because my sister has cerebral palsy and it's been hard. I have to like tutor her in math and I have to show her you can't really write it out and it takes a few hours, but she's doing really good, so I know what you're going through.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for your question. Let me say one final thing about the book that... if you buy it, I thank you. If you like it, I'm honored. If you love it, please share it, give it as gifts. And if you find it deeply meaningful, please do something about it. Do something. Don't just read it and like it. Do something. One final thing. All of the profits from this book are going to both Cure Autism Now and children's charities in general, all the profits. Thank you.
Thank you again to Dan Gottlieb and to Mike and Scott for sharing their time with us. Just a reminder to those of you who walked in late, Dan is not signing books. If you purchase a book, and I would encourage you to because it's a wonderful book, we'll give you a book plate, but we are having... a greeting line, and that is a greeting line, not a counseling line. So, again, for counseling and issues, go to letterstosam.com, and thank you very much for joining us. Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.